Well, it began as an effort to help farmers farm in hard times, but grew into a $300 billion effort to help just about everyone do everything for everybody all the time. This federal farm fiasco leads us to ask, should the United States eliminate its farm bill and just start over?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 908th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Port Stanley who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Ricochet on the boards. Hello, Rick.
Good day, Michael.
Also, producer Dylan Thompson on the stories. Hello, Dylan. Forgot to turn your mic on. Say it one more time.
Morning, Michael.
All right, there you go. Well, folks, you've heard by now, of course, that we are falling off a fiscal cliff, being crushed under a collapsing debt ceiling, and having our government allowance chopped off by a sequester cleaver. Now hear how we are looking at having a food bomb explode in our face. It began as an effort to help farmers farm in hard times, but grew into a $300 billion effort to help just about everyone do everything for everybody all the time. That effort to help farmers began with the Federal Farm Loan Act of 1916 and was made permanent by a provision of the Agricultural Adjustment Act of 1938 that says, in effect, that if Congress does not pass a farm bill, the federal government will then have to provide financial support to farmers by artificially inflating the prices of commodities that the farmers produce. Thus, milk that now sells for $2.10 might have to be sold for $5.20. That is the food bomb. To avoid having this food bomb explode in our face, government dutifully passes a farm bill every 5 years, except for this year. This year, government could only pass a short extension of the farm bill, and thus we are still looking at having the food bomb explode in our face on October 1st. This federal farm fiasco leads us to ask, should the United States eliminate its farm bill and just start over? Well, here to help us figure out how to answer this question, we have Burley Leonard. Burley, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Good to have you aboard. You're a food and ag consultant for the Prime Policy Group. What's the Prime Policy Group?
Prime Policy Group is a government relations firm in Washington, D.C. We have a host of different clients, and we try to watch out after those clients' interests in both the federal, state, executive, and legislative branches. So I guess, in short, you can call us a bunch of lobbyists.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up, because I always wanted to ask for the other side of the lobbyist story. You know, we all hear about how bad lobbyists are, but I would like to, I've always wanted to ask a lobbyist, what do you do that's not so bad?
Well, the way that I look at it, it's kind of like in a court of law. Everybody's entitled to seek representation, mm-hmm. and we have clients who have issues before the government. They seek to have their views represented before the policymakers, clearly with an effort to shape those policy decisions in a way that benefit them. And if you have everybody with an opportunity to get their voices heard and have their day in court, hopefully the best decisions come out at the end of the tunnel.
Well, you know, in thinking about that, I was wondering how else we could do it. If there weren't lobbyists, how could anything possibly work then? I mean, if there weren't people there to fight for people, you know, to have somebody's your position known in the halls of Congress, who would represent you?
Well, I think there would be a vacuum, at least with respect to information and different options to pursue a specific type of a policy formula that you may have to seek. It just strikes me that the more transparency you have, the more voices you have putting in their two cents worth, the better the chances are that you'll get a more informed decision coming at the end of the process. And if you remove the people's voices, whether it's through a lobbyist or through themselves directly, you, I think, increase the odds for results that will lead to unintended consequences, much like our Farm Bill has.
Amen, that's where we're at today. So is it true that you take congressmen on golfing vacations to Tahiti all the time?
I don't golf, therefore I have never suffered to play a round of golf with a member of Congress in my entire life.
There you go. Well, really, the federal government can't agree on a farm bill this year, and thus we have what you call in the Wall Street Journal, a food bomb ready to explode in our face on the 1st of October. What exactly is the food bomb, and why is it set to explode on October 1st?
Well, I think you summarized it pretty well in your intro, Mike. The situation that we currently have is that the 112th Congress, which just completed its work, was unable to complete work on a farm bill.
Which meant that it didn't really complete its work, did it?
Correct. And interestingly enough, this was the first time in history where a Congress brought up a farm bill for consideration but could not complete it by the end of its term. So we're somewhat in uncharted waters. When we got to January 1st, without a new farm bill, we were confronted with the prospect of milk prices that were double what housewives were seeing in the supermarkets. And that, combined with a need to provide a semblance of stability for farmers as they make their decisions in the upcoming planting season, Congress saw fit to at least extend the current farm bill through the end of September of 2013. Mm-hmm. So while they avoided the ramp up in milk prices, they'll have to revisit the whole matter in the coming months.
It seems like we are becoming very adept at kicking the can down the road.
That's the name of the game in Washington, D.C. these days. When you have such a gulf between the two parties, a gulf between the House and Senate, a gulf between many in Congress and the White House, it's very difficult to bridge it. And people have a very hard time coming to any kind of concrete final decisions. Therefore, the reaction is, let's punt and see if we can't regain some field position and have at it again. It's a tough way to run a country, but it's the pattern we've fallen into in the last 2 to 3 years.
Well, in doing so, it's kind of directly reflecting the electorate at large, right? I mean, were we not split as a people, we would probably not be split as a government.
The people get exactly the kind of Congress that they elect, and we all have to remember that. We are prone to kind of lay the blame on members of Congress. Their approval ratings are below that of used car salesmen. And
hey, now go easy on the used car salesman.
Will do. But the fact is that their approval ratings are lower than a snake's belly. How's that?
That's good.
And they are, but they reflect the people and views and positions of the electorate that sent them to Congress. So we kind of have to look at ourselves in the mirror and accept part of the responsibility for the paralysis in Washington, D.C.
Well, yes, and had it not been for our decision, you know, I'm sure they would be able to decide, but we have not been able to decide out here which direction we want to go. So that's the indecision we've essentially foisted on the federal government. And so because of this indecision, we're stuck with kicking the can down the road, as it were, and one of the cans that we're kicking down the road contains what you call a food bomb. What do you mean by the food bomb?
Well, as I was saying, with respect to various things like dairy, wheat, cotton, rice, corn, you have a situation whereby if Congress cannot complete its work on a farm bill and fails to extend it, permanent law takes effect. Permanent law is the underlying statute that's a product essentially of the Great Depression.
Well, we're going to pick that up when we come back, but it sounds kind of depressing. Permanent law is going to take effect. We're all going to have our necks stretched. Oh, my goodness. Folks, this is The Food Chain, Michael Olson. We're talking about the Farm Bill, or the lack thereof, with Burley Leonard. And you, do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, folks, we simply can't make up our minds to go one way or go the other way. And so that's the message we send to our government. We don't know what we want to do. So tell us what to do, government. The government looks at us and says, well, if you don't know what to do, well, we certainly don't know what to do, so nobody does anything. And thus we're kicking things, our cans down the road and hoping for somebody to make up their mind someplace. One of the problems we're having here is one of the things we can't make up our mind about is the food bill, is the farm bill. The farm bill has been around for a long, long... Really, you talked about the first time ever in history we've been unable to make up our mind about the farm bill.
That's correct.
How long is that history?
Well, we've had a succession of about 15 farm bills, each of which is about a 5, maybe 6-year span. So, you know, we're talking 75 years here.
So the first time in 75 years we're unable to make up our mind about how to go about managing the basic commodities of our agriculture.
That's correct.
Wow. That says something about where we're at, I guess. Well, let me ask you, my first question here is kind of a, I do, in thinking about this, why do we manage our agriculture in the first place?
Well, I think we have to start with an understanding that back in the 1930s, when all of
Great Depression, right?
Right. When all of the farm programs first took root, you were dealing with a society where 25% of the population lived on the farm. 44% of the population lived in rural America. Contrast that with 1% of the population living on farms today. We had a very different makeup of our population at the time that these farm programs took root. And when faced with the Great Depression, the folks in Washington figured out, and probably rightfully so, that to get the country back on its feet economically, you were going to have to do something with respect to that 25% of the population that lived on the farm. And so what they decided to do was to artificially inflate the farmer's income by virtue of increasing the prices that were paid for the commodities that he produced.
Uh-oh.
And
you're
going to
start talking about parity now, aren't you?
There's always that threat hanging over our heads. In order to determine what price those commodities should be supported at back in the 1930s, they selected a period of time known kind of as the golden era of American agriculture. Golden era in the sense that the prices that farmers had to pay were very low compared to the prices that farmers got for their commodities. And so they picked this period of 1910 to 1914 as the relationship to maintain between prices that farmers pay and prices that farmers receive. And so when you apply that parity index from 1910 through 1914 to the price situation we have today with respect to prices paid and prices received, you have a situation that is just bears no resemblance to current market prices for farmers' crops.
Except that it's the law that if we don't pass a farm bill, that then the federal government will have to step in and force this parity onto farm commodities.
That's correct. And so if between now and the end of October, Congress fails to either write a new farm bill, or they could always, you know, engage in another exercise of kicking the can down the road by extending the current law for some additional period of time, we could see a situation where we would revert to these parity prices. And let me give you a sense of what that means. You are talking about a current market price for corn somewhere in the neighborhood of $6.70. Parity price for corn is $12 per bushel.
Wow.
For wheat, current prices for wheat, $8.40 per bushel. If we have to revert back to 100% of parity, you're talking about $18.30 per bushel. Rice, 100 weight of rice, current market prices, $14.70. If we had to revert back to 100% of parity, you'd be talking about $42 for 100 weight of rice. Milk, this is the last example that I will give you. 100 weight of milk, currently roughly $22. At 100% of parity, you're looking at $52.10. So you're talking about reverting to huge price increases in the basic commodities that go into our everyday diets.
So in other words, if the Congress doesn't get around to figuring things out and passing a farm bill, our food is going to go through the roof. Literally. It's just going to go way, way, way up.
You could have a situation where you would be looking at 40 to 100% increases in the prices of the commodities that are used to make the foods that we eat on a day-to-day basis, and in the process, turning a rather routine trip to the local supermarket into a very much a walk on the wild side, full of shock and awe.
Well, of course, they're not going to do that. They're just going to kick the can down the road some more.
Probably so,
because, they, of course, would not be able to do something like that and go home and visit their constituents, because it just wouldn't work out too well, I don't think. So this Adjustment Act of 1938 was essentially a Depression-era New Deal, government New Deal. And it just never went away, did it?
Not in terms of serving as permanent law. What Congress would do from time to time is they would say, well, you know, things are kind of changing in the agricultural sector, where rather than limiting production, which you have to do in order to sustain prices at such a high level, we've got a Second World War coming, and we're going to have to gear up our agriculture production in order to feed the troops. And so what you saw was at based upon a set of changed circumstances, Congress would make some mid-course adjustments mm-hmm. to the law. But they would do it for only a certain period of time, 4 to 6 years. And then, at the end of that 4 to 6 year period, when the current law was about to expire, they were confronted with the choice, as we are now, do we go back to the old law, or do we make some further mid-course revisions to where we've been? And so far, the result has been, over those 70-plus years, a decision that we're going to make some further mid-course adjustments, bring our laws into more alignment with the realities of what's happening in the marketplace, be it a growing world population that needs to be fed, be it these incredible advances in scientific knowledge and technology that allows us to get more crops out of an acre of land. All these externalities have impacted the agricultural sector, and in doing so, Congress is always in the process of having to kind of catch up with the changes that are mm-hmm. happening in the real world and have the agricultural policies be more reflective of that reality.
What happened to that farm bill? So the farm bill essentially is just a periodic adjustment to the permanent law.
That's correct. In fact, the way it's written is for the next 5 crop years, our commodity programs will be designed, you know, A, B, C. At the end of that 5th crop year, if we have not decided to make adjustments so that the commodity programs are now D, E, and F, then we revert back to the permanent law. And what is interesting is that the further away you get from that permanent law, the greater the degree of change in the realities of the world around you, and therefore the greater the dislocation that you would have to suffer if by some stretch you had to revert to permanent law. So that's why there has always been this incentive to kind of make these mid-course adjustments. And
that's where we're at right now. We're making a mid-course adjustment on this radio show. We will be right back after these important messages to discuss what happened to that farm bill. Hey, it began as an effort to help farmers farm in hard times, but grew into a $300 billion effort to help just about everyone do everything for everybody all the time. And perhaps that's why we're having such a tough time coming to grips with the farm bill that nobody can seem is able to pass in Washington, D.C. Really, is that the case? Has our farm bill become so complicated and with so many people, you know, taking part in it and benefiting from it that it's just no longer a farm bill, it's an everything bill?
Well, I think you've put your finger on part of the problem. There is a huge, diverse constituency of interests that are affected by a farm bill. We've been talking about the impact of the farm bill on farmers. Clearly, that's the case through the commodity price support programs. But 80% of the farm bill costs goes to food nutrition programs, things like food stamps. You have a whole different set of interests tied up in what happens to these feeding programs that the government provides for the less fortunate among us. In addition to that, you have conservation programs. So many environmentalists are concerned about preserving the conservation programs to maintain the soil and water resources that are important not only for farming, but a host of many other uses. So you have a wide diversity of constituents having an interest in this omnibus farm bill. But you marry that with the fact that we're all living under a need to reduce spending, and you add kind of fuel to the fire. Not only do you have a disparate number of varying interest groups interested in getting their piece in the farm bill, but they're having to deal with a shrinking pie. They're having to deal with fewer and fewer dollars to address the issues that they want to have dealt with in the context of the farm bill. So under that kind of a scenario, a lot of people with different interests having to compete for a shrinking pie, you create you create the opportunity for gridlock that stands in the way of reaching enough of a consensus to allow the passage of a bill.
Mm-hmm. And so someplace, somewhere along the line, we the people kind of have to make up our mind as to which direction we want to go here. So maybe we could open up the phone lines today and ask our audience which way they think we should go with respect to our farm bill and our government and everything else. What should we do out there? Should we borrow more money, I guess, and keep things going the way they are? Or should we try to come to grips with the fact that we're out of money and do something about it? The phone number is today, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080. We are talking with Burley Leonard, who is a lobbyist. He even admitted to it. And we're happy to have a lobbyist because we're curious to see how things really take shape in Washington, D.C. Burley, you must, sitting in the catbird seat as you are there in Washington, D.C., it must be quite a struggle over the farm bill.
Well, it clearly has been a struggle, and frankly, there's no end in sight as I can see. The elections in November did not really change the balance of power, so you still have the same confrontation of Democrats in the Senate, Republicans in the House, and President Obama occupying the White House, and that has not changed. The differences over spending and taxes has not changed. You still have these very wide differences of opinion as to how we go about dealing with what I think everybody does acknowledge as the threat of the size of our budget deficits and our overall national debt.
Mm-hmm. So we find ourselves in a situation where we're broke.
Right.
And yet we find ourselves in a situation where we're paying the Rockefeller family to not farm on their hunting lodge through the farm bill.
Well, that may very well be the case. I'm not really sure what that situation is.
I'm not either. I just read it. I thought, that's incredible.
When you deal with farm program that has the government in the position of having to decide how much of a particular crop can be grown, and trying to do that without being able to control the weather, you're going to experience unintended consequences, and that is part of the problem that we have. Government being so up to its eyeballs in so many different areas of our lives that there are going to be slips between the cup and lip, and you're going to have unintended consequences. And if the Rockefellers are getting paid for not planting on their, lodge, maybe that's a good case in point of unintended consequences.
I guess so, or something like that. Well, we're going to go to the phones right now, folks. We're going to start off with Randy, who's calling in from Michigan. Randy, you got any snow up there?
Yeah, we just got some fresh stuff for you.
Well, good.
Happy to send you some.
Please do. I love it. As long as I can only take a bucket full at a time, I guess.
Right.
But having been raised in Montana, I know what it's all about.
Good. Good. Yeah, well, I had a few comments and then a couple of questions. Burley was mentioning the radical improvements in agriculture. I'd like to point out that those radical improvements are not isolated to agriculture. We've had those technological improvements in every area of our society. Why agriculture is singled out for punishment for adopting such practices is very curious and not understandable to me. I'd also like to point out that the obligation for the parity pricing persists regardless of any farm bill. It stems from the declaration of an emergency over agriculture in 1933, was reestablished as a declaration of emergency in 1937, after the Supreme Court struck down the original AAA Act in the Hoosac-Mills, or the U.S. v. Butler decision. And Congress came back and redeclared the emergency and adopted a policy that said, okay, we're taking the marketing rights of farmers in the national public interest. That's a taking of private property. We need to provide parity compensation. That's our policy that's still in current law, 7 U.S.C. 602. And so that persists. The farm bills are adopted to avoid the persistence of that obligation.
Randy, do we still have an emergency?
Yes, we do. It's never been declared over.
Oh.
Yeah.
Who would declare it over? I mean, who declared it in the first place?
Congress did.
Congress did. We're back to them guys.
May 12th of 1933. You can read it in current law, Title 7, Section 601. Read the notes to that section. It'll say that it was affirmed, validated, and reenacted without change in June of 1937.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick break, but when we come back, would you like to ask your question?
Yes, please.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. Today we're talking about the Farm Bill, or the lack thereof, with Burley Leonard, who is in Washington, D.C., fighting for his clients for the Farm Bill and whatnot. He is a food and agriculture consultant. And you, 831-479-1080, 831-479-1080, we will be right back. Welcome back out there. Hey, Randy from up there in frozen Michigan has got a question for Raleigh, Burley. And are you guys any snow in Washington, D.C., Burley?
No, sir.
You missed it.
We did.
Okay, Randy, go ahead. What's your question?
Well, my question is that the analysis of the costs of the farm bill are always laid to what gets paid out to farmers, and they never consider the other side of the circulation where it comes back in the form of taxes, the ability to pay taxes, increased incomes and increase of business activity, employment improvement, and all the rest of those factors. So the question comes, if the total underpayment, below parity payment to agriculture since 1952 is equal to the national public debt, why is this so hard to understand?
Wow. You got me there. Burley? Thank you, Randy.
You're welcome. Thanks for taking the call.
Yep. I don't know how to answer that. Do you?
If the point is that the investment by taxpayers in the agricultural sector has generated economic activity, which in turn has generated tax receipts into the federal treasury, my understanding, based upon the question, is that isn't that a good thing? Clearly, that's a good thing, but the reality is that we are living in a world where the cost of government programs overwhelms our ability to pay for them, and we have to make a decision as to whether we're going to make adjustments. If we are going to make adjustments in order to address the spending problems in the context of a farm bill, we are going to have to make painful cuts for a whole host of different constituencies. Otherwise, we continue to spend at the rates we are, and there's a pretty strong consensus that this country can't continue to do that and maintain the standard of living and the style of life that we've become accustomed to. So I don't know that that answers his question head on, but it's the best I can do, given what I understood to be the basis of his concern.
Well, I know what let's do. Let's ask Teresa what to do. Teresa, what should we do?
Well, I've got 4 points to make, and I will make them really quick.
Okay, fire away.
So my first is...
But wait a minute. First you have to tell us what we should do.
Oh, no, this is going to tell you what you should do.
Okay, go ahead.
What we should do. So first, I can't afford a lobbyist. If I need a lobbyist in order for the government that I elected to listen to me, then I think the government deciding how I can feed my family is too big.
All right, just a minute. Burley?
I don't take issue with what she said.
Okay. Teresa,
All right. Number
two.
Second point. I buy my milk in bottles, and it is definitely not subsidized. So I'm already paying the true cost of food, which is what prices would go to. And that's called the free market. If I'm now paying the true cost of my milk, I'm also paying, through those subsidies and my taxes, for GMO corn to feed the subsidized cows and for oil subsidies to bring that milk in from Brazil, if that's where the cows are. I want to pay just for my milk.
Burley?
Pay for just your milk and insist that the government get off the track of taking these other decisions on GMOs and foreign imports and things of that sort, so that you don't get confronted with having to pay these extra costs. You call into your congressman and raise the roof.
I bet Teresa could do that. Number three, Teresa.
So number three, most of the people on food stamps are in rural areas, meaning they are farmers who can not only afford to make a living, they can't even afford to feed themselves on the amount that they make from farming. That's because the subsidies are creating cheap food, and people are not paying the real cost of food. So if we didn't have these subsidies, we wouldn't need the food stamps.
Burley?
If we didn't have the subsidies for
agriculture.
If we didn't have the subsidies for agriculture, then we wouldn't need food stamps?
For people who live in...
Five commodity products.
Well,
Let's go to number four, Teresa.
Okay, so my last point is that if we were paying twice as much for our food and that money was going to the producers so that they could make a good living, and we were paying half as much for our mortgages, which is money going to idle bankers for something that they have not done anything to create, we would be four times better off.
Ooh. Burley?
She's entitled to her opinion.
There you go. And she takes it. Thank you very much for expressing your opinion. That was a pretty good one. Let's try Annalise.
Yes.
Welcome to the food chain.
Thank you, and thank you for a fascinating subject. I think a lot of us are rather confronted by the enormity of the information, and then how to resolve, and we're supposed to come up with some really good answers.
Annalise, you have to decide what we want Congress to do. And we have to take a break right now, but when we come back,
you
have a couple of minutes to figure out exactly what you want the federal government to do, because your decision is what they're going to hear. And that decision, you're going to force that government to make a decision when we come back from this break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, what on earth are we going to do with the farm bill? We got to do something. If we don't do anything, the food bomb's going to go off in our face October 1st. We're going to have to pay hundreds of dollars for a gallon of milk or something like that. And we don't want to do that, so we have to make a decision. Which means we have to encourage our Congress people to make a decision. And Annalise is going to tell them what to do when we get back, so do stay tuned. Well, what's the answer? What are we going to do? Annalise is going to tell our congressman what to do. But first, I'd like to throw this out from Rob Rommel, who is the farm director at WoWo, in Mighty WoWo in Fort Wayne, Indiana, who sends in this suggestion. I have suggested to congressmen that the farm bill be split into two separate bills. First and foremost, because the farm bill gets all the blame for the massive expense because our name is in the title. Since 80% of the expense of the bill is for food stamps, let's call it the food stamp bill instead and see where the political pressure takes us then. My position is that when we should separate the two and allow them each to stand on their own merits. Well, Annalise, have you decided what we should do, what our Congress should do with respect to the farm bill? Are you there? I guess not. She ran away. Well, Burley, what do you think?
Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
You just got me to the wrong button, I suppose. Yes, I have an answer. I don't know if you're going to like it.
Oh, okay.
But I think we should send you and someone really bright and sharp and formulative, down to earth, like Teresa, to counter lobbyists and the general government itself. Because I think she comes up with some very concrete answers. And, you know, the idea of splitting the bill that was just suggested by an email, that sounds like an excellent program. Because it's not, it shouldn't be coming down to Republicans versus Democrats, people versus, you know, money, but it's always that. It's always that. But if we could send you and Teresa, I think you and Teresa would get together and do some wonderful changes. How's that?
Okay, fair enough. Thank you very much for that call, Annalise. I really appreciate it. Burley, Leonard, what do you think we should do? I mean, you're the one that's sitting here watching this happening. What on earth should we do?
Well, there is going to have to be some kind of a decision made as to the total amount of dollars that Congress is going to have to shave off the farm bill. And in order to do that, we're going to have to reach an understanding that everybody's going to have to give some. And there are a lot of people who object to the notion of across-the-board cuts, but absent any ability to agree on a priority for what gets cut and what doesn't, we may have to resort to just that kind of a meat cleaver approach where everybody takes the same percentage hit.
Mm-hmm. What about the whole notion of getting rid of the farm bill and starting over?
Well,
I mean, why are we living under a permanent farm bill that was crafted at the height of the 1930s depression by some politicians back then? I mean, why are we living under this? Scheme. Why don't we chop the thing in two, make a food stamp bill and a farm bill, and then let them hack it out that way?
Well, my suggestion at the very least is this notion of an outdated permanent law creates a real threat if we get to the point where we can't kick the ball down the field.
Mm-hmm.
And so therefore, rather than being confronted with having to resort to permanent law and all the economic dislocations that that would cause, better to return to a free market where supply and demand operate to allocate resources to the most efficient use, and people are not subjected to the kinds of unintended consequences that we've talked about.
Couldn't have said it any better myself. Burley Leonard, thank you for joining us, and thank you all for tuning in the Food Chain. See you next week for more What's Eating What Radio.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.